The streets hold many secrets. From alleyways in the heart of London to the quietest country lane, they've all witnessed cruelty and violence, jealousy and despair. They've seen crimes of passion and cold-hearted murder. They've seen killers escape and killers brought to justice. In this series, we'll be investigating the most notorious crimes and intriguing mysteries. Stories of men and women who killed, of the police who hunted them, and the victims who were left behind. From the files of Scotland Yard and far beyond, this is the dark history of our streets. The 31st of August, 1888. London clattered with traffic, with industry, with all the endless din of the largest city in the world. It was, for most Londoners, an ordinary day. Many would have picked up a newspaper, perhaps the Globe or the Pall Mall Gazette, paying as little as half a penny for their latest dose of scandal, gossip, sport, and, of course, crime. In the Star newspaper that day was a story from East London. A revolting murder had taken place, a ghastly crime, the deed of a maniac. Not all the newspapers paid the story so much attention, but they soon would. That murder on the 31st of August was just the beginning. Over the next 10 weeks, an anonymous killer murdered four more women in the East End. The police were seemingly powerless to stop him. This two-part episode will tell the story of those terrible weeks, how the murders were discovered and how they were reported, how the women killed came to such tragic ends, and how a sadistic murderer has become a folk legend. We know him today as Jack the Ripper.
I think the reason why the Ripper murders still exert such a fascination is that we've glamorized them. What we're actually looking at is a series of very brutal murders.
Endless books are written. The Ripperology is a whole genre of study in itself, and there are museums being opened to this person who may not even ever have existed.
It's very telling that we as a culture are so fixated on Jack the Ripper, and that we haven't really, for more than 130 years, paid that much attention to who the women were who he killed.
For me, the Whitechapel killings are almost better understood individually from the point of view of the victims and from the point of view of what it tells us about Whitechapel at the time and about society at the time.
Much of what we know about the Whitechapel murders comes from press reports of the time. Police records have been almost entirely lost, destroyed or discarded over the decades. Our attitudes towards the victims, our theories about the killer, in fact, even the most basic facts about the case, all come to us, filtered through the newspaper reports of 1888.
I think you can get very interesting information from them about contemporary attitudes, contemporary concerns, but they are themselves contradictory.
If you take 10 different versions reported in the newspapers of an inquest, you will get 10 different versions of what was said. So you can't take a witness's statement on face value because we don't even know what was said verbatim.
Even sometimes in individual papers, you would see contradictions in their accounts from one day to the next. Also, we have to remember that the press were there to sell these stories, and a good story was more important than an accurate story.
By the 1880s, the newspaper industry in Britain was booming. Advances in technology, changes in taxation had driven down the cost of a paper, and journalism was becoming more flamboyant, more informal, with provocative headlines that leapt off the page. The increasingly literate Victorians gobbled it up in unprecedented numbers.
In a day when there was no wireless, no television, no social media, newspapers were people's way of finding out about what was going on.
The literacy rates were high, about 75% for men, 70% for women, and just the sheer number of titles was off the scale, even compared to today. In 1884, there were no less than 15 evening papers, there were 9 weeklies and 383 London locals. So the whole city was sort of swimming in news.
You have new papers being founded which are intending not to appeal to the educated middle classes, but intended to appeal to a lower middle class and mass working class audience.
In 1885, the Pall Mall Gazette helped change the law on prostitution. The campaigning journalism of its editor, W.T. Stead, harnessed public outrage to political ends. Parliament was forced to pass new legislation. And that Criminal Law Amendment Act raised the age of consent for girls from 13 to 16. It suppressed trafficking and prostitution, and indirectly, it helped create the Whitechapel of Jack the Ripper.
Stead timed those articles, the maiden tribute of modern Babylon, quite literally for the closing days of July in 1885, to force Parliament to rush that legislation through. The real intent had been to establish an age of consent at 16, but an unexpected clause was added which criminalised brothels.
Although the idea was that it was protecting women and children, those who were already embroiled in prostitution at the time meant that they had to ply their trade in common lodging houses or out on the streets instead.
Those streets were among the most dangerous and crowded in the country. By 1888, Whitechapel was notorious.
It was believed to be a place that actually sort of sapped the soul from your very body because it was morally degenerate. So it was referred to as the continent beyond, and the people who lived there were called the people of the abyss.
You would have a lot of very poor dwellings, a lot of people who had virtually next to nothing and were scraping a living without today's welfare state, social security. There was nothing like that.
It was also an area where there was a lot of immigration at the time, particularly the Jewish refugees from the pogroms in Eastern Europe and Russia. But there were also Irish, French, German refugees as well.
There were racial tensions, there were social tensions, and it was just rather an explosive melting pot of people.
Give you some idea of the scale of overcrowding. Outside London, there were about 50 persons an acre. In Whitechapel as a whole, it was 175 persons an acre. But in the killing ground of the Jack the Ripper murders, in the Dorset Street area, the density of population is over 800 persons an acre.
Whitechapel had a dark reputation, and its streets were even darker. At night, the West End lit up with fiery threads of gaslight. But much of East London was dark and dangerous. Whitechapel itself was a gloomy maze, punctuated by pinpricks of light. It was the perfect hunting ground for a killer. It was not yet 4 in the morning, and the streets of Whitechapel were quiet. The few gaslights there were barely pierced the gloom, and a visitor could soon become lost in the twists and turns of the passageways and yards that knitted the district together. But Charles Cross knew those streets. The 39-year-old worked as a porter and was on his way from his home in Bethnal Green to his job in Broad Street. His route took him along a street called Buck's Row. Cross was nearing the local board school when he spotted something. It was a woman, slumped in a gateway. Not an unusual sight in Whitechapel, where rough sleepers were common, but something about this figure made Cross pause. Another man came up the street. Cross beckoned him over. Together they crouched by the woman. Her hands were cold. She was dead, they decided, or dead drunk. Not wanting to be late for work, the two men hurried on. They would tell the first policeman they saw what they'd found. But in the close darkness of the night, neither man had noticed the deep cut slicing across the woman's throat, nor the blood pooling on the stones beneath her. It was only when the body was taken to the mortuary that the true extent of her injuries was discovered. The woman had been mutilated after death. Jagged wounds ran down her abdomen, cutting through skin and deep into the tissue beneath.
It's one of the reasons why her case got so much attention. This wasn't just killing. This was brutality of a kind that was unusual.
In those days, there wasn't the same level of crime scene preservation as there would be in modern times. There wasn't any forensic science. There wasn't any forensic pathology as we would understand it today. So, you know, the body had been washed before it was properly examined by detectives.
To many in the press, it was no surprise this had happened in Whitechapel. The East End was a pit of depravity, after all, a foreign land of immigrants and criminals that would swamp the rest of London if left unchecked. The previous autumn, hundreds of the unemployed and homeless of the East End had gathered at Trafalgar Square. Each night, closely packed rough sleepers had filled the benches and flagstones surrounding Nelson's Column. And each day, the square was filled by countless more, protesting against economic hardship and inequality. To the right-wing press, this was a violent mob, and police attempts to clear the square were applauded. On the night of the 24th of October, 1887, 10 troublemakers were arrested. Among them was a woman who resisted her trip to the cells. She swore and she fought. According to police, she was the worst woman in the square. Her name was Mary Ann Nichols, and less than a year later, she would be found lying dead in a gateway in Bucks Row. But Nichols had not always been that rough, sleeping nuisance to the police. It was not so long before that Mary Ann, or Polly, as everyone knew her, had a husband, a home, and a family.
She was the daughter of a blacksmith. She married William Nichols, a printer, at the age of 18, and they had five children together.
Being a printer was a good job. It wasn't an extremely well-paid job, but it meant that they were respectable and deserving poor. So when George Peabody began his scheme of social housing in the capital, and the organization was looking for deserving families, the Nichols were judged to be amongst them.
Polly's happy life was not to last. She and her husband William would continually row. Polly found comfort in the bottle, and William in the arms of his widowed neighbor. By the end of March 1880, Polly was worn out. Aged 34, she left her family, never to return.
How women were treated in those days, they had no sort of property rights of their own very often. They didn't have the means of independent living. If you had a job, then quite often you'd be okay. But if you lost that job, if women in service, say, got pregnant, they were thrown out and they had no recourse at all, particularly if their family disowned them. So they just had to live by their wits in any way they could.
A woman had no function without a man and without a family. If she wasn't a carer, if she wasn't looking after children, if she wasn't looking after a household or her husband, there was nothing that she conceivably could do within this world.
Perhaps for protection, perhaps for money, or perhaps simply for company, Polly took up with another man. But this only pushed her further into misery. In 1882, her husband found out and used it as evidence that Polly was committing adultery. A magistrate agreed, and the weekly payments were ended. Life for Polly became even harder. She was in and out of various workhouses, on and off the streets. Her only comfort was drink.
The system was rigged against you from the beginning. You didn't have much hope of finding a way out of difficult circumstances. The whole purpose of the workhouse was to punish people for being poor.
The idea being that only the most desperate of people will go in there, but you wouldn't want to go there if you had any other option.
She did go into service briefly, but absconded with her employer's clothing. And eventually she found herself in Whitechapel.
She had been drawn very clearly to Whitechapel because that's where you found the cheapest lodgings, the cheapest booze, the kind of people that she could mix with without being lectured, preached at, and harangued.
On the last night of her life, Polly was drunk. Leaving a pub shortly after midnight, she tried to get a bed at Wilmot's lodging house on Thrall Street, but with no money, she was turned away. 2 hours later, Polly's friend, Ellen Holland, bumped into her on the street. Polly was too drunk to stand up straight, and Ellen tried to convince her to come back to a lodging house, but Polly refused. At 2:30 in the morning, Ellen watched her friend stagger into the darkness. A day had passed since the discovery of Polly Nichols' body in Buck's Row. Now rumor and speculation were spreading through the newspapers. For Polly was not the first woman in 1888 to be murdered on the streets of Whitechapel.
As news of Mary Ann Nichols' murder came out, people and the press, and indeed some police officers, linked it to two murders that had happened already.
Spring of 1888, Emma Elizabeth Smith had been brutally murdered, but she lived to say that she had been brutally hurt by a group of men.
It's commonly thought to be that she was attacked by a high rip gang, who were gangs who went around extorting protection money from prostitutes.
Earlier on in August, Martha Tabram was stabbed with a bayonet, and it got into the newspapers.
This was an era which saw poor women as morally defective. So, of course, they're going to look at these women, at these murder victims, and think, well, you know, these women were whores. What were they doing outside by themselves with no family in the worst part of town late at night? Well, they must have been prostituting themselves. It was said in a newspaper that when leaving Wilmot's, Polly turned around and said, I'll get my DOS money soon, see what a jolly bonnet I have. How this could be construed as proof that she was going to go out and prostitute herself, you know, is absurd. It could be a throwaway comment. She might not have even said it. It's a very Victorian way of looking at women.
With no further developments by the end of the first week of September, press and public interest in the story was beginning to wane. But all that was about to change. It was shortly before 6 in the morning, and John Davis was coming down from his room at 29 Hanbury Street. He was new to the lodging house and hadn't slept well. 16 other people lived in the building. With so many comings and goings, the front door was always left open. Anyone could get into the building or go through it down the passageway to the small yard at the back. This was a well-known fact to the local prostitutes and rough sleepers. That was where Davis found Annie Chapman.
The killer felt he had the time to spend on her body. And he brutalized that body.
Annie's throat was cut, as with the previous victim, but there was much more violence to her body here as well. Her intestines were severed and flung over her right shoulder, and several of her organs had been removed as well.
He laid open her abdomen from just below the rib cage downwards to the crotch, hauled out her entrails, and removed with a sharp knife her uterus and part of her vagina.
It was the start of rumours that there had been medical doctors who were keen to have fresh organs for medical purposes, and that the person who was doing the Whitechapel murders were actually trying to kill prostitutes in order to remove their organs for some kind of, you know, bizarre medical research.
Annie Chapman's body, unlike Nichols' body, is seen as much more threatening because it does suggest you are talking about a madman, somebody or somebody who is evil of an extreme that you don't expect. This is the stuff of nightmares.
Police were on the scene within minutes. A crowd gathered, rumours spread. Telegrams and messages were soon shooting out across London to Scotland Yard and to the newspapers. To many in the press, the killing of Polly Nichols had been unusual only in its violence. But this second brutal attack in little more than a week transformed the story. The Whitechapel murders were now a major media event.
The Jack the Ripper murders was one of the first instances of a media frenzy.
Because the area was so small, it was easy enough to follow the detectives or policemen making inquiries. So if you can imagine, a policeman goes to one house and sort of asks various questions, the reporter is immediately behind him saying, "What did the police tell you?" And so this information is then put into the newspapers, which of course completely hinders the investigation.
A lot of the newspapers would have their own editorial slant on how they saw the murders and the background to them.
The liberal and the radical press, for example, were heavily critical of the police for the way they went about their investigations. In particular, The Star, which was a radical leftist paper, really had a vendetta against the police commissioner, Charles Warren.
Because we had the riots in Trafalgar Square the year before, Warren had used police, troops, cavalry to put down these riots. There was this great hatred for him from the working class, and so newspapers and editors like Stead mounted campaigns against the police.
Other papers had different approaches to the murders. The Daily Telegraph, for example, emphasised the vice and criminality of the people of Whitechapel and talked about how the authorities needed to be regulating them, particularly those who lived in common lodging houses and prostitutes. The East End press, the local press, were very defensive of the Whitechapel area and were quick to point out that lots of many respectable people lived in the area too.
Whichever newspaper readers chose, in the coming days, they were to read all about the dead woman's terrible injuries. They would have learned less about the real life of this second victim. As they sat comfortably in their drawing rooms or parlours, absorbing the sensational details, readers would not have guessed that she had once been a woman not unlike themselves. She was born Annie Eliza Smith. Her father, George, was a trooper in the Household Cavalry, the handsome regiment with plumed helmets and shining breastplates that still guards the sovereign today. Growing up so close to royalty, however, offered no protection against the vicious illnesses of the Victorian age. In 1854, when Annie was just 12, scarlet fever entered the Smith household. It killed four of Annie's siblings in just 3 weeks. The deaths of his children was a tragedy from which George Smith never recovered. 9 years later, he would take his own life. In order to survive, Annie's mother took in lodgers. Among them was a young coachman named John Chapman. In 1869, he and Annie were married.
This was quite a high-ranking servant. He would have been paid very well. And for a time, Annie and her husband lived on the country estate of their employer outside of Windsor in their own home.
Then the photographs we have of her, taken from her respectable days, she looks a comfortable, relatively homely woman.
It really demonstrates the ambitions of the young Chapman couple. Annie is wearing a brooch, she's wearing earrings, she's wearing an ornate belt buckle. John Chapman is standing proudly, displaying his pocket watch, which was an essential piece of kit if you were a coachman. And a picture like this would have been designed to be put on a mantelpiece. And to have a mantelpiece, you would have probably had to have or aspire to have a parlor, which was pretty essential if you considered yourself middle class.
Years later, similar photographs of their two daughters would be taken. But Annie's happy life was less secure than those images of middle-class aspirations suggested. For like Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman was an alcoholic.
We know that she liked having a drink. We know that she actually sought refuge in drink from the tragedies in her life.
She had inherited the disease from her father, and the family, seeing that she had real trouble coping, put her into one of the first women's rehabilitation centers for alcoholics in England at the time. Annie spent a year in rehab, and everything seemed to be going along quite well when she returned. Unfortunately, she lapsed, and this was the final straw.
By the autumn of 1888, Annie's addiction had taken her from the haunts of royalty to some of the poorest streets in the country. She was nearing her 47th birthday. She was penniless, depressed, and dying of tuberculosis. On the night of September the 7th, Annie didn't have a bed to go to. What pennies she had begged, borrowed, or earned that day had been spent on alcohol. She lingered at Crossingham's lodging house as long as she could. Finally, shortly before 2 a.m., she was turned out onto the streets. She would never return. Just 8 days separated the murders of Polly Nichols and Annie Chapman. With the second killing, police came under increasing pressure to find the murderer. But they would have little to go on. A witness claimed to have seen Annie outside 29 Hanbury Street just half an hour before she was killed. She was with a man described as foreign-looking. A few minutes later, a young carpenter entered the yard of the house next door to number 29. He said he heard a woman cry no and something fall against the fence, but he didn't think to investigate further. The theory of a gang of blackmailers was abandoned. Now police were convinced the killer was a loner targeting prostitutes, and they had a suspect.
The press had a field day with these murders and conjured up all sorts of grotesque characters who could have been responsible, one of which was Leather Apron.
He was looked for because in the yard where Annie Chapman, victim number two, was found, there was a leather apron found on under the tap.
There were stories going around of how he was terrorising women of the East End, and everyone seemed to know him and seemed to have a story about his violence. He was described as being about 5'4", with dark hair and a dark moustache. He was thought to be Jewish in appearance.
Almost inevitably, when these foul murders materialised, the finger pointed at the Jewish population of the East End, because it was a very lazy but quite convenient leap to make.
He was suspected because he fit the bill, because he was not one of us, because he didn't look as if he was a nice man. He looked alien, and so he was an ideal candidate.
John Pizer was his real name. He was a Polish bootmaker with a reputation for threatening prostitutes. He owned long-bladed knives and knew how to use them. On the 10th of September, police tracked him down. But Pizer had alibis for both murders. Once these were confirmed, he was released. Police and the newspapers had to find a new suspect.
The police drew in a lot of extra patrols. People were on the lookout. A lot of people were actually arrested.
There was a man called Piggott, for example, who was arrested at Gravesend on the 9th of September because people had seen him in an altercation with a woman in Whitechapel and he had a suspicious injury to his hand. He was later declared insane and sent to an asylum.
If you're looking for a murderer, how on earth do you actually sort of catch anyone? Take the lodging houses in Dorset Street. You'd have over 100 people in each lodging house, so you'd have 700 to 800 people in that street. How on earth do you interview them? You can't. For numbers that size, you need computers.
So little confidence did local people have in the police that they formed their own vigilante groups. Egged on by the press, their suspicions soon fell on foreigners. After all, such hideous crimes couldn't possibly have been the work of an English Christian. Whitechapel seethed with fear and mistrust, and the newspapers feasted. Murders were good for business. Sales that September reached record levels, sustained by the official inquests into the killings which now began. These provided new information about Polly Nichols and Annie Chapman's deaths. The newspapers, of course, reported them in eager, graphic detail.
There weren't the same protocols in relation to what should be publicised in relation to these sort of crime inquiries as there are today.
Huge amount depends on the journalist, on editorial policy, on the will, therefore, to sensationalise, to titillate, to add individual bits and pieces to what a victim may have done, what a witness may have said.
This grew out of a sort of wider interest in crime narratives that we get in the 19th century, like Penny Bloods and Penny Dreadfuls, also Newgate novels, which blurred fact with fiction and really sensationalised crime.
I think it says a great deal about the appetite of the time for it to be sensationalist and exciting and melodramatic, particularly when it didn't directly affect you.
New horrors were expected each day, but weeks passed with no more murders. Interest outside Whitechapel inevitably drifted. The press could only keep recycling the same stories and the same speculations so many times. The police offered them no cooperation, and there was no sign of an arrest. Sales began to drop.
Editors and the news barons would have become more restless the longer the amount of time that elapsed without another grisly murder, because that was their oxygen.
The public were waiting for something else to happen, and it didn't. And there was certainly a drop in circulation of some of the newspapers, particularly the very sensationalist ones, like The Star, who really sold their papers on reporting on these murders.
Then, on the 27th of September, the Central News Agency in London received a letter. In many ways, it was not unusual. Police and press alike received hundreds of letters from the public about the case. Most were at best well-meaning but useless. Many were simply deranged. But this letter was different. It was signed with a name nobody had heard before. But it was a name nobody would forget. Jack the Ripper had been born.
It first of all mocked the police for their arrest of Leather Apron. It warned that there would be new murders soon. And the author said that he would clip off the ears of his next victim and send them to the police.
It was written in reasonably good handwriting. It's signed, "Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Don't mind me giving my trade name."
There were several names that were being bandied around by the press to describe the killer. Things like the fiend and ghoul and madman, maniac. But there was no one single moniker that was used, and that's what made Jack the Ripper so powerful.
Jack was a good name to choose. In many ways, you could say it was an inspired name to choose. Jack is a name that carries a certain rascality with it. You know, Jack the Lad, Saucy Jack.
It sort of heightens that sense that the killer was hiding in plain sight, lurking in the midst, could have been anybody. I think those two things together, the plainness of Jack versus the horror of Ripper, has this grotesque collision that really lodges in the mind.
There'd also been some mythological Jacks before this. So Springhill Jack, this strange figure that leapt over buildings and was terrorising London, seemingly, in the 1830s. Also Jack Shepherd, the 18th century burglar who was known for his daring prison breaks. Both of these figures had been mythologised in crime fiction, and Jack was to join their ranks.
The killer had a name to remember. Many at the time thought the letter must be real. Researchers today are more sceptical.
I am absolutely one with those who believe that they were completely fake. They come at a time when the media needs a new boost.
Members of the police force thought that it was actually journalists from the Central News Agency who forwarded the letter onto the police who were responsible.
It's something which keeps people buying newspapers, a new instalment for people to pore over. I think that's really the significance of those letters. I don't think they tell us anything about the killer.
Despite the eye-catching name, the Central News Agency apparently showed little interest in the letter at first. Just another hoax or crank like all the others. But on the 30th of September, newspapers were once again filled with stories of murder on the streets of Whitechapel. As he had promised in his letter, Jack the Ripper had struck again. Twice.
It's a very, very confused night. The two bodies are discovered within the hour.
It would be very, very unusual for the two murders so close together not to have been linked.
Some people suggest that the Ripper was actually interrupted partway through this murder, and that's why he went on to take a second victim.
I don't think you can understand just how panicked people were.
In the next episode, the double event strikes panic into Whitechapel. Newspaper sales reach new heights, and the murders escalate in violence.